An effort by the Cuomo administration to publicly undermine an investigation into the governor's alleged conduct has raised questions about free speech and witness tampering following public statements from the governor's top lawyer and the assembly member leading another inquiry into the administration. To break down the legal war of words, we're joined once again by Rob Rosbrough, author of the New York Appeals blog at nysappeals.com and a litigation partner with Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna. Welcome back to the show, Rob.
Thanks for having me again, David.
So at issue here are comments from Cuomo spokesman Richard Azzopardi, who has ramped up his attack on the credibility of the investigation into his boss by the state attorney general's office. Assembly Judiciary Chair Chuck Levine, a Long Island Democrat leading a separate inquiry into Cuomo, said last week in a letter to the governor that Azzopardi's PR campaign undermines the AG's work and sends negative signals to witnesses. Cuomo attorney Beth Garvey then responded in a statement that there is a big difference between actionable retaliation and protected speech, adding that Assemblyman Levine, quote, doesn't understand the difference, end quote. Is this issue really as cut and dry as the governor's top lawyer contends?
It's not. The governor's top lawyer is being an advocate for her client, and that's the governor. She's trying to paint the picture as this is a very clear issue when it's not. You know, Azzopardi's, you know, speech about, you know, the potential political motivations of the investigation, that's political speech. It's traditionally protected under the First Amendment. But it's not as clear cut when that speech could serve to undermine an ongoing investigation. You know, there are certainly standards for what can and should be said when you have an ongoing investigation and you're commenting on the investigators. But when you have political speech that could interfere with investigation, there's other considerations that need to be thought about. You know, you can't have a governor or his spokespeople interfering in an investigation by, for example, intimidating witnesses. That would go beyond what would be permissible.
I'm glad you bring up the witness tampering or intimidation, which are concepts listeners are probably familiar with from trials on TV and in movies. But in those cases, there's a trial that you're interfering with and a judge who has, I guess, the authority to intervene. With this investigation, what legal mechanism has the authority to weigh in on potential tampering or interference?
Well, I mean, so there, you know, New York has criminal codes that would cover conduct where, like obstruction of justice or obstruction of an investigation or witness tampering. But those, you know, those are such high standards. It would be, you know, probably a district attorney or maybe even the AG herself farming it out to a special prosecutor if that was something that they thought would be worthwhile. But here, what Azzopardi said, saying that the, you know, the attorney general has political aspirations to run for governor, that doesn't even come close to, you know, criminal conduct. It's just speech intended to paint, you know, the political aspects of what the governor has fears about the ongoing investigation.
So when Assembly Judiciary Chair Chuck Levine says that Azzopardi's conduct may, quote, merit severe repercussion, what he's talking about is potentially that witness angle, not necessarily the part of the speech that could undermine the way the public will perceive anything that the investigation by the Attorney General's office produces?
Right. That's my understanding of what he was talking about. He doesn't want the governor's, you know, PR campaign to affect a witness's willingness to come forward and talk to the investigators. You know, they want to make sure that everyone feels, you know, safe in coming to speak about whatever information they might have. And saying, you know, things like this is a politically motivated investigation or, you know, commenting otherwise on the investigation itself would tend to, you know, dissuade witnesses from doing that.
So this is an investigation and not a trial. But if this was a trial, how would a judge potentially act if a party in one of their cases was essentially running a public relations campaign on the side?
It depends on how it depends on a lot of considerations. So trial judges deal with this in high profile cases all the time. They, you know, for example, they could, a trial judge could tell the parties, you're under a gag order. We're not going to allow you to speak to the media during the pendency of this trial or case or whatever it is, because it could influence the jury pool, or it could, you know, have some sort of impact on the fairness of the trial. And the judges have discretion to do that. But what's been done so far, you know, it's not that concerning. It's just typical political speech that you see in Albany every day.
In other legal news, a federal judge this month invalidated a decision by the New York Racing Association to prohibit horse trainer Bob Baffert from running horses at their tracks in New York, including the Saratoga Racecourse this summer. Why did a federal judge reverse NYRA's prohibition of Baffert, who came under fire after his Kentucky Derby winner Medina Spirit tested positive for a banned substance?
Well, it was all about due process. So what the judge said is that in order to suspend Baffert for, you know, Medina Spirit's positive test in Kentucky, or any of the, you know, varying explanations Baffert gave after it, the NYRA owed Baffert some due process, which means they needed notice of what was going to happen and what of the suspension. And what happened here was Baffert just got a medal or a letter in the mail that said, you're hereby suspended, without any notice prior to that. And then they needed to give him either a pre-suspension hearing or a post-suspension hearing, and it didn't do either. What NYRA had planned and what they said at oral argument in front of the judge was that they were going to decide the length of Baffert's suspension upcoming at their next meeting in August, then maybe a hearing after that. And the trial judge said that, I'm sorry, you know, not Saratoga's meet is one of the preeminent meets throughout the country. If Baffert were to be able to miss that, that's irreparable harm to, you know, his income and to his goodwill in the horse industry. Owners had already moved their horses to other trainers because of the suspension, and the trial judge wasn't going to allow that type of irreparable harm to happen without Baffert having an opportunity to make his own case to NYRA why he shouldn't be suspended.
And why are we talking about due process with regards to what is essentially a private company's decision about who gets to play on their track? Why can't they just take their ball and go home indiscriminately?
Well, because NYRA certainly has a common law, which is, you know, basically case law right to exclude people from NYRA's tracks, but it's considered a state actor in a number of decisions over the last, you know, decade or so since it was taken over by the state in 2008. NYRA has become a state actor, and thus, you know, the constitutional protections for due process apply. What the trial judge said was NYRA is so intertwined with the state for the operation of the race courses that you can't distinguish the two. And anytime NYRA takes an act to suspend or revoke a license to be at one of NYRA's tracks, they have to follow these articulated processes before, you know, suspending someone.
And in terms of the process that NYRA might have had to follow in order to actually suspend Baffert and have the suspension upheld by a court, it seems like the judge, while saying you needed to follow at least this type of step, didn't really talk about the standard for actually suspending Baffert. So it seems like as long as they went through the motions, they could have suspended him regardless of what might have been said at any hearing post or pre-decision.
I think that's right. You know, they could have, you know, held a hearing and allowed Baffert the opportunity to, you know, explain the prior doping violations, explain what happened in Kentucky, explain, you know, anything else he wanted to bring in front of NYRA's board that would consider the disciplinary action. And then the board makes an evaluation of whether they felt the suspension was warranted. You know, if they decide that he should have been suspended, then you satisfied due process. And the only thing that their decision is reviewed for after that is arbitrary, which is a very deferential standard. So if they had just gone through the motions, you know, and told, you know, Baffert that we plan to suspend you, but here's your opportunity to make your case at a hearing, that would have been enough.
And finally, turning to the state's court system, as we see many aspects of life return to some form of normalcy, we're hearing that the court is also looking more and more like what it used to look like in terms of in-person proceedings. How is that affecting your life right now?
Well, you have judges who are scheduling more and more in-person hearings and arguments. For example, the Court of Appeals is going back to in-person arguments in September. The appellate divisions are basically doing the same. And really, if you want to argue in court without a mask, you can get permission from the court system to do that now if you can show proof of vaccination. So, you know, things are headed back toward normal court operations with people back in courthouses, though we'll see how long that lasts with the, you know, the concerning information we're getting about the Delta variant.
Are there any aspects of judicial life during the pandemic that you think should stick around after the pandemic, whether it has to do with maybe some sort of additional use of online components or something else?
Yes. So the courts move to Microsoft Teams and virtual platforms for, you know, what would otherwise be really short status conferences has been very useful for me and for a lot of practitioners, I'm sure. So I have a number of cases across the state where we've done court conferences that I would have had to drive to Rockland County or out to Syracuse, and we've done 5-minute Teams meetings with a judge or one of the judge's clerks. And I've even done mediations over Zoom or Teams that have been very, very useful. And it saves the clients a lot of money, and it saves us a lot of time, and it's good for the administration of justice, I think.
And is there any sense of whether these virtual proceedings are going to continue into the future, or will they end as more and more of the in-person activities resume?
I think it depends on the status of the case. I think judges will be more likely to ask the attorneys and litigants to come in person when there's something consequential going on. For example, if you're right before going to trial, the judge is going to want to sit in person with the advocates because they can make, you know, the discussion a little bit more forceful when you're sitting in front of the judge. But for preliminary and initial conferences or just quick status updates to a judge, I would expect, you know, phone conferences or video conferences to stay because they've just been so useful. And the judge can get through so many different conferences in a day than you normally would be able to when you're relying on advocates to show up from all over the state.
Are you wary at all of having to wear suit pants again? Because I have to imagine with all these Zoom meetings, you can do business on the top and, you know, casual pajamas on the bottom.
Very much. It will be a change in the practice of the last year and a half, but I guess hopefully all the pants will still fit.
Well, we've been speaking with Rob Rosbro, author of the New York Appeals blog, which you can find at nysappeals.com, and he's a litigation partner with Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Rob, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again, Dave.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.